It was an extremely hot and humid day on August 9th, 1987 in Philadelphia. 1631 North 19th Street was an area with numerous drug busts and several abandoned buildings, most with the doors and windows boarded up. The apartment complex at 1631 also looked abandoned, as several windows were broken and the front door was missing. Harrison Graham, or Marty as he was known, was evicted from his apartment due to terrible odors emanating from his residence. Before he left, he took most of his belongings and nailed the door shut. When the landlords couldn't get into the apartment later, the police were called and their discovery shocked the entire city. Welcome to History's Biggest Villains. Harrison Graham was born on September 9th, 1959 in Philadelphia, the oldest of five children. Early on in childhood, he showed signs of an intellectual disability and had problems with his grades and discipline in school. Graham attended Olney High School, where he was forced to drop out after the 10th grade due to his failing grades and truancy. In the early 70s, Graham worked several odd construction jobs. In 1979, he left his parents' house and moved to North Philadelphia, living in an area filled with poverty and crime. During this time, he began to drink and use drugs, spending time amongst pimps and prostitutes. A tall and athletic man, he wasn't violent towards anyone and was never prosecuted for any crime. In 1983, he rented an apartment in a housing complex with mostly vacant spaces. A number of residents, including Graham himself, fenced off an area of the apartment parking lot as a place to buy and sell drugs. In the following 4 years, Graham turned his apartment into a drug den, where friends and acquaintances would often visit to buy and use drugs. Nevertheless, Graham was never known to be violent, regularly paid his rent, and played basketball with the local kids. He was living off his disability pension and was described as a nice man by friends and neighbors. During the summer of 1987, neighbors in the apartment building at 1631 North 19th Street consistently complained of a foul stench coming from Harrison's apartment. The landlords contacted Harrison several times about this, but he ignored all of their messages. Finally, on August 9th, he was forced to leave his apartment. Harrison then boarded up the front door, gathering up his belongings, and left out of the fire escape. When the landlords couldn't get into the apartment, they called the police. Officer Pete Scalatino was the first to respond to the complaint. He recognized the scent of death as soon as he entered the dilapidated building. He climbed the stairs to the third floor until he reached an apartment where the odor was most pungent. The front door, which was accessible from the hallway by an open door, was filled with old food containers, molded newspapers and magazines, dried feces, and filthy clothes piled knee-high. Pete walked past the kitchen to a door he assumed led to a room. The smell was getting worse, and he felt certain the cause was coming from behind the door. The name Marty was etched into the door, and below was an open keyhole. He leaned down and peeped through, able to see a human figure. He demanded that the door be opened, but the legs that he could see were oddly still. Scalatino called for backup. With the help of investigator Charles Johnson, the door was pried open and the body of a black woman was lying on a pile of mattresses. The body was bloated and decomposing. Next to the mattresses was a second body, another female sprawled dead on the floor. The two men needed more help. It was difficult to assess whether the deaths were drug-related or homicide. As detectives began to show up, a crowd also gathered. The conditions within the building were an obstacle and police taped off the scene. And as authorities filtered through the waste, a third body was discovered beneath all the debris. The remains of this victim were skeletal, which means she had been there for a while. The search continued. The officers wore masks as they walked through syringes and spoons, broken glass, and dog feces. Within a few more hours, they uncovered a fourth victim. This body had been carefully mummified in sheets. A search that had begun in the early afternoon was now into the sunset hours. At 5:30, the search party discovered body number five, sandwiched between two mattresses. This body hadn't been wrapped or bound, but was left to decompose past the point of gender identification. An officer called to the men in the back room as he had found a sixth body in the front closet, littered with garbage and dingy old clothes. With a body count at six, the search was called off until the morning. Crowds of people gathered around the building, beyond the neighbors and locals. The media had caught wind of a potential serial killing spree in urban Philadelphia, and news teams were gathering among the homeless, pimps, prostitutes, junkies, and other desperates of the community. The next day, the search was widened to the outside of the apartment. Officers and crews began to dig. A search on the roof uncovered a dismembered leg and foot. Morning newspapers displayed the tenant's picture, a handsome younger black man appearing in healthy physical condition. His name below the picture read, Harrison Graham. An All Points Bulletin had sheriffs and officers and every other authority in the area on the lookout. The victims were sent to the morgue for autopsy, and no signs of physical trauma or violence were found. The first two bodies had decomposed rapidly due to the climate. They, in fact, had only been dead for a few days. While the coroners were able to assess their gender as female, the other victims were less identifiable. During all this, the Daily News printed a story about the relatives and friends of Cookie Mathis, a victim. Her husband heard about the shirt found in her body and knew it was his wife. He had bought it for her. Within the week, the public would serve to be more helpful in helping police identify the victims. The media was running stories about the madman on the loose as Harrison was still at large. A husband came forward to inquire about his wife, who had been missing for over 2 years. The roommate of another victim told police that she believed Sandra Garvin had gone to buy drugs from Harrison and had not returned. Debris from the crime scene filled in missing pieces. Jewelry, including a heart-shaped necklace and three earrings, helped to identify two other victims. Harrison Graham was still nowhere to be found. The sought-after suspect had four younger siblings and his mother, Lillian, all living in the Philadelphia area. The family put out a public plea for Harrison to come home. He'd been seen in local shelters, even at a bus stop, but somehow he evaded capture. While the office personnel worked tirelessly to piece the puzzle together, Lillian Graham received a phone call. It was her oldest son, hungry and tired. He wondered if she could meet with him and bring him something to eat. According to Harrison, his mother was able to talk some sense into him. "Stop running, son. Whatever happened, we can work this out. Just come on home. We love you. Your family loves you." Harrison then waited at a street corner for the police to pick him up. It was getting late, but the officers continued to press Harrison until he finally admitted that he played a role in the murders of the seven women. He had tried for hours to convince the men that the bodies had been there when he moved into the complex. Reluctantly, he would admit to one killing, then finally relented and told the whole truth. With a twist, it may have been his hands, but it was not his mind. It was Marty, he explained. When Harrison was a young boy, his family situation was not always right. At an early age, he was both the lover and employee of a male pimp. Troubles at home led him to the streets, where for the first time he claimed to have felt deep love. He was introduced to homosexual relationships, prostitution, and drugs. In his early teens, his mother's own spiritual revelation was imposed upon him. She dragged him from the streets and began to preach the sins of his lifestyle, one that she hadn't been involved in for a very long time. Among his victims was his former girlfriend, Robin DeShazer. Graham stated in an interview, "I wanted so badly to love her, but I couldn't stop my need to do the other things. I never liked the sex, and it got so much easier when I didn't have to see her." To explain, Harrison somehow felt more at ease having sex with his girlfriend once he had strangled her. In a sense, he had said, his secrets were safer with her dead. She knew about Marty and his desires. I didn't want her looking at me that way, and I seen God being angry through her eyes. Harrison Graham lured all his victims, whether he knew them previously or not, with drugs. Consensual sex led to strangulation, which Harrison explained always shocked him in the morning when he'd wake up and find a dead woman lying next to him. Harrison confessed to the police that after he killed DeShazer, he was so shaken by what he did and was so afraid as to what to do next that he simply left her body in his apartment. It was not until he brought a different woman to the apartment that he attempted to hide her by throwing the corpse on his roof through a bedroom window. During the interrogation, Graham wrote a 10-page confession. However, during his arraignment, the question of mental illness was the topic. Joel S. Moldavsky was appointed his public defender. And immediately, the point of whether Graham had been capable of signing his own confession was argued. While detectives claimed that the confession had followed procedure, even with Harrison's mother present, Moldavsky was able to successfully point to due process conflict. Harrison, he claimed, was never told that he had a right to have an attorney present. On August 27, 1987, a detective read through the gruesome account of findings during a six-hour hearing. Harrison was reportedly agitated, rocking back and forth as the detective read that he had described maggots in his apartment as furball bugs to a visitor. He had to stay high all the time to ignore the birds eating a body outside his apartment. Drugged and in a paranoid state to begin with, Harrison panicked when the police arrived, literally throwing bodies in the back bedroom. Until this point, he had all the corpses in the front room. In a rush, he quickly boarded up the door and ran. This, according to Joel Moldavsky, among other bizarre behaviors, were paramount in determining his client's competency. Dr. Robert Stanton, a psychiatrist, evaluated Graham, citing an IQ of 63. This, coupled with his substance abuse and addictions, resulted in a man who by law was incapable. Harrison was suffering from chemically induced auditory hallucinations, psychosis, blackouts, and chronic paranoia. A psychologist testified that apart from Harrison's drug abuse and mental issues, he was incompetent in reading, writing, math, and telling time. Despite all this evidence, the judge declared him fit to stand trial. Moldavsky was arguing insanity, specifically a multiple personality disorder. During an interview with Philadelphia's Daily News, he commented that Harrison often spoke in a second and third personality. Marty was an easygoing handyman. He liked his mother. He was straight and extremely religious. At times, Junior would show himself. This personality was most familiar as the childlike male who neighbors remember hanging on to his Cookie Monster stuffed animal. It was Frank who was responsible for the heinous crimes of both murder and necrophilia. It was Frank who couldn't stand to be with a woman, in brutal contrast to Marty, who hated the sinful nature of homosexuality, who felt it was a condemnation to eternal death. Frank, however, was streetwise, with a desire for drugs and homosexual relations, including his own prostitution, something that he had been introduced to in his own childhood. Lillian Graham was her son's greatest ally. She didn't believe that Harrison would be capable of such horrible crimes. She said that he was too simple, too nonviolent. According to her, he would not have the wherewithal to plan such crimes and hide bodies. As adamant as she was, she guided her son away from the jury trial, explaining to him that while he was innocent, she knew that the jury would be prejudiced once the prosecutors revealed their crime scene photos. You're telling him that he's innocent, but then you know that once they see the photos of all the dead women in his apartment, they're not going to say he's innocent. Like, what are you trying to... Okay, I'm not... Wow. Like, are you with him or not? Then, just before the judge's rulings, the prosecution brought a surprise witness, Paula, a woman who claimed to have lived with Harrison. She accused him of strangling her during sex, causing her to pass out at times. She also said that during the 3 years she lived with him, he had bragged about strangling Robin DeShazer and then having sex with her dead body. Paula had been frightened that he would do the same thing to her if she broke up with him. According to her testimony, Paula had endured rape, beatings, and torture at the hands of Harrison Graham. However, this revelation did more for the defense than the prosecution. First, Robin had been beaten, not strangled, leading to the conclusion that the witness had lied about her former boyfriend's testimony. Harrison also had no history of long-term relationships. In fact, he had killed his only so-called girlfriend. It didn't fit the pattern of Graham's murders or the personality to have maintained a three-year relationship with any woman. If anything, Paula's statements that Harrison kept her in drug-induced states and was often using himself only added to the defense's claims that he was not in control of his facilities. On March 8th, Harrison told the judge that he wasn't responsible for his crimes and that someone else had done it. Harrison put his fate in the judge's hands, waiving his right to a jury. He was found guilty of 7 counts of first-degree murder and 7 counts of abuse of a corpse. His attorney told reporters that he doubted Graham knew that he'd been found guilty or what the ramifications of what that would mean. He then directed his attention towards keeping Graham from execution. Harrison listened to his conviction, barely making any expression. Afterward, he told reporters that everything would work out just fine. He requested that his Cookie Monster be given back to him, now that it was no longer needed for evidence. In May, Judge Latrone ruled that while he would sentence Harrison to 6 death sentences, he would first be sent to prison to serve out a life term. The single life sentence was for DeShazer's murder. She was the first, so there was no other murders to add aggravating factors. Graham was also sentenced to serve 6 consecutive sentences of 7 to 14 years each. Harrison's mother was absent for the ruling. Until 1994, Harrison Graham was a prisoner at Harrisburg Penitentiary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But then the Supreme Court deemed his sentence unethical and illegal. The court ruled that Graham's life sentence be overturned and that the death sentence be implemented. I've never heard of that before, ever. He was then scheduled to die on December 7th, 1988. Judge Latrone again had to make a decision to let Graham live or die. He stayed the execution. The murderer's case seemed to spend much of his time in appeals and in and out of higher court, until in 2002, the Supreme Court banned the executions of all mentally disabled criminals. Harrison didn't meet the initial requirements of the ban. As stated by a psychiatrist involved in this case, he tested lower than he functioned, so even if his IQ was below 70, he was not mentally disabled. But because, according to the criteria established by the American Psychiatric Association, an onset of mental illness occurring before the age of 18 mandated the same relief from execution, Harrison was permanently off of death row. Today, he lives in a medium security facility in Pennsylvania. His case manager described him as mild and nonviolent. He has received a minister's certificate and continues to practice his faith. 7 bodies in your apartment. And then when you get caught, you magically just develop all these personalities. You might have been, okay, he might have had some intellectual disabilities. But if you murder one woman and keep murdering and keep killing and keep killing women, like, it's kind of showing that you kind of know what you're doing at this point. He had the wherewithal to hide the bodies once the police came. He ran, so he knew what he was doing. Like, he's caught. Like, come on, man. You stop that stuff, man. You get caught, and all of a sudden, oh, I'm mentally just, like, you might have had a low IQ, but you still knew what you were doing. You still knew what you were doing when you killed all those women. Thank you for listening to the story. I hope you enjoyed it. Leave a like. Hit that subscribe button. I'll turn on my post notifications if you haven't already. Thank you so much for all the support you guys have given me. But I'm out. Be safe. Stay on the grind. Peace.